Hello, my name is Dave Hanrady, and there will be no encore. Welcome to episode 61 of the No Encore Music Podcast. That's not the regular intro music, is it, Craig Fitzpatrick?
Angelo Badalamenti. How are you?
You brought back the nickname.
Yes, of course, because it's Twin Peaks Day.
It's Twin Peaks Day. How are you feeling, Cullum or Regan?
I'm keeping it together, to be fair.
How do you like your coffee? And all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, totally.
So Twin Peaks is back after 25 odd years.
Been waiting. Not 25 years, but I've been waiting a while. Very excited.
So Craig, you are a huge fan of this show.
Yeah.
Talk to me
about
it.
Can only disappoint.
Now, I'm currently watching it pretty much for the first time because I was too young when it was on the air and my brother watched it. So I knew the big kind of moments and stuff, but I just put off a rewatch for years and years and years, and now I feel like I really, really got to get back on the board. Loving that first season. I currently have 7 episodes left in season 2 and I want to stop watching.
Yeah, I suppose the good sign is that you love all the Lynch stuff and he's directing all of the new episodes. So
that does sound good. I've been unusually confident about this. I think it's going to be great, but I'm struggling with the season 2 back half.
Yeah, it just got ropey as all hell. I mean, just some terrible directors got on board. They didn't know what they were doing. But enough of that.
But you're such a fan, though, that yeah. you will defend this at the end of the year. I mean, like, you could argue that, you know, wait a minute.
There's
like,
still some entertaining, just ridiculous bits. And
perhaps, you know, the majority of the show, can it really be hailed as one of the great shows, as it often is, if so much the show is filler and it's not great?
Yeah.
I feel like...
No.
It's more...
Oh, hold on. Hold on a second. What was that?
A mysterious man just entered the room.
Is that Wyndham Earl?
No, it's producer Alan.
Oh, shit.
Hello.
Making his on-action podcast debut.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's see what's going to happen here. Alan, have you seen Twin Peaks?
I've seen 1.5 seasons of Twin Peaks.
That's about right.
Yeah. I've seen the first half of season 2.
Okay.
All of season 1, which, granted, is good. And then I just couldn't. I couldn't keep going with season 2. I just don't understand. It's not fun at all. And so I don't get why it's held up as so great a TV show.
I guess, first of all, just the premise, the atmosphere, and also kind of, I mean, it ushered in a lot of ways that kind of golden age of TV, didn't it? Because it just took so many chances, and I think maybe the impact and culturally in terms of what Lynch was doing on the small screen is more important now than the fact that there was a ton of ropey episodes in the second series. But yeah, completely goes off the rails. But again, not really David Lynch's fault.
But the second part of season 2 is worse than the first part of season 2.
Well, the first part of season 2 is pretty good, isn't it? No, it's
once they wrap up the mystery,
yeah.
And then once like a certain character exits the show, I have to
that's
say
kind of it.
The drop in quality is so strange. It genuinely comes across like a brand new show,
yeah,
written by totally different people who don't know these characters, and the new characters are all awful. Like, I'm actively skipping some scenes at the moment, and I'm just like, but I hear the finale is amazing.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Now I know what happens at the crux of it because it's just one of those TV moments that you see for years and years and years. But like, God, it's tough. And also, by the time that this podcast comes out, I will have gotten through the episodes because I have to get through the last 7 episodes by Saturday evening because I'm going to go see Fire Walk With Me in the cinema.
Where did the movies come into it? Are they good?
There's just one.
Oh, one
There's
movie.
Just
Sorry.
One. Yeah, it's actually kind of a prequel.
At
the time, it was absolutely slammed because people wanted a continuation of what they got from Twin Peaks. But it was just, it's essentially a horror film. It's really intense.
It's got David Bowie.
Brilliant. It's really good. But yeah, at the time, it did terrible business. But it's kind of a classic. I think it's been... It's now looked as a kind of classic.
I think so. The big question, though, Craig, is, particularly if you're up early for work, are you going to watch the 2-hour Twin Peaks comeback live at 2 in the morning on Sunday night / Monday morning?
No, I'm not. And I was going to say because I'm on earlies, but that kind of means I could get up
super early.
That
makes it a lot easier for you.
Yeah, you should totally do it. Although... What a way to go to work. Like, I start the week.
Yeah.
That Craig just walking in, just eyes glazed over. Like, what's going on, Craig? None.
Like, when it was announced last year, it might be 2 years now at this stage, I remember just people online being like, very seriously saying, okay, I'm going to rewatch all the episodes, obviously. I'm taking the week off work. This is exactly how I've laid out my week. I'm going to be meditating beforehand. I'm going to be drinking David Lynch's brand of coffee. And I was just like, it's a bit much, isn't it? And now I'm like, I should have done that. So I'm hype.
Right, well,
Alan, will you be tuning in?
Yeah. Well, definitely not at the time.
Yeah.
But I'll probably watch it. Do you
Somebody's
think
got
be...
work to do on Monday morning.
It's on at a reasonable hour on Monday evening, I think. Isn't it? Yeah, it's like 9 p.m. kind of standard Sky
Atlantic. Do you think I will have had to watch like season 2 to understand?
No, you're grand. I think you're set. pretty much.
Get hype.
Get hype.
For Twin Peaks. It's back.
Woo!
And we might have Alan back on the show at some point in the future. Who knows?
Yeah,
some
I'm down with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks, no Alan. Promises
and
were made there,
all,
Dave.
Thanks for all the lovely audio.
Yes.
And enjoy the audio inserts for this episode.
Of which there shall be many.
Lots of songs of the week, man.
Heavy lifting.
Can't
heavy.
Wait. Genuinely can't wait.
Thanks, man.
Okay, I'll just let myself out. You continue.
All right, okay.
He's going to start slamming around the studio, isn't he?
People love this kind of stuff, though, the ambience. And
is that right? Point.
Yeah, I think
is
so.
Is that like a thing?
I think so,
does
yeah.
that make us more relatable?
I don't know.
We're the podcast next door.
Yeah, kind of. Maybe. I don't know. I always liked us being kind of aloof podcast that people didn't really like.
We've always seemed attainable to other people.
Yeah. Yeah. We're coquettish, but you could totally land us, basically, is where we're going with that. Have a good one, man. Take care. Good luck.
Right. We move to music now, and a story that's broken in the past couple of hours. A very sad story of the death of Chris Cornell. Obviously, this episode is going to be dropping in a few days' time, in which stage there'll be an awful lot more information out there. We are not in the practice of sitting here and speculating, so we will not do that. But either way, at 52 years of age, it is horrible, horrible news to wake up to.
Yeah, and adding to kind of how surreal it seems, I mean, obviously because of social media and just YouTube and stuff now, like you saw his tweets from last night, just hours before he passed away, and he was doing a show with Soundgarden. There's YouTube footage of the show itself, and he looks and sounds in absolutely fantastic form. So a real kind of shock. And such an influential musician. I mean, a huge part of that grunge scene. A lot of people would consider him the kind of godfather of grunge. Even among kind of such illustrious musicians, he was kind of seen early doors as like the leading figure before Nirvana.
They signed a deal before anyone else did, basically, in that scene. And as well, he was, I guess, a guy who just sort of pushed the boundaries a little bit from that point onwards. He was never afraid to kind of change things up.
Yeah, like he was never a kind of careerist type. He just was genuinely into the music wherever that took him, be it like kind of acoustic-y stuff, be it like, obviously then he did an album with Timbaland, which was widely derided at the time. But he took chances and he didn't really give a feck, and that has to be applauded.
And one of those voices as well that was so distinctive and like forever in your kind of childhood,
amazing.
Your adolescence, your nascent music loving earshot. When it came to that kind of grunge crunch, I suppose, for whatever reason, I was more of a Pearl Jam guy than a Nirvana and a Soundgarden guy. But I had time for all of them, of course. And you read kind of biopics around the time, and it sounds like such a very interesting group of people to, I guess, hang out with if you were to look at it, if the writing is that good. And it kind of brings you back to that kind of sense of place and time, which a lot of the books I read around the time did. And yeah, this is a horrible, horrible loss, particularly because, I mean, like, well, not particularly because, but certainly in light of the fact that he seemed to be kind of, you know, he had it back together, and like Soundgarden came over here recently, and I know some people who went to that gig and said that he sounded better than ever. They sounded even better than when they saw him in 2003 when he came over here with Audioslave. And Audioslave were a band that I actually quite loved at the time. I remember when that first record came out, I was still in school, I was working in a supermarket job, and I remember the first day I got it on my lunch break and listened to some of it at home before I went to my job. And I remember like going to the job and being like, all I want to do is keep listening to this record. Like, it was an immediate impact. Yeah. I mean, like,
was huge at the time, because it was massive. Rage and fucking that voice. What?
Yeah. I remember reading about it like way in advance. And, like, at one point the band was called Civilian, and then they changed it to Audioslave.
Yeah.
Naming might not have been their strong suit, but the tunes certainly were impactful. And I mean, like, remember like Cochise coming out and that amazing build up with that video. And that's one of those, like, you know, you knew where you were when you first heard it or saw the video kind of song. Like, it really had such a kind of like a real massive impact. The follow-up records weren't quite as good, but I still go back to that record. Like, I actually watched Collateral again recently, and even though the usage of Shadow on the Sun is quite jarring, and it's probably down to the fact that Michael Mann was a fan more than anything else, it's also an incredible moment, that bit in the film where the coyotes come onto the highway or the freeway.
Fantastic.
And Jamie Foxx and Tom Cruise have that moment of existentialism. Now, this is a horrible, horrible loss. This was an awful thing to wake up to as well, and just like trying to process it, as we will in the days coming. But rest in peace, Chris Cornell, and thank you so much for all of the great music.
Well said.
In other news, Craig, I think, will have a lot more on this one, because, you know, you're a business journalist these days, man.
I am, yeah.
You're keeping in touch with all the movers and the shakers, and some of those movers and shakers are politicians. And that's, you know, like, the British election's coming up now. I hesitate to go to you, Craig, because the last time we had a massive British upheaval thing going on, you did famously declare that Brexit was not going to happen.
Yeah. Stands by that.
So what are...
I also said that Trump was definitely not going to win.
So for a hat trick, Craig, tap in for you right now. Who will the next Prime Minister of Great Britain be?
Theresa May. Okay. And okay. I'm glad, everyone should be glad I'm saying that. Especially Big Jezza.
Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, I mean...
Down with the kids?
You got a feel for the guy, don't you? Like, at this stage, it's just like he's such a well-intentioned, very intelligent man that has, you know, like... very good ideas about, you know, making society a bit more equal, and he's just constantly getting slammed until now.
Yeah, but he's huge in the grime community. Yes, that's got to be worth something.
Yeah, the grassroots support is out, and it sounds like grime, which is very much now
a genre that you notoriously struggle with.
I do. Like, obviously, Jeremy Corbyn's
privileged upper class leanings. Do you feel a bit more in tune with it now that that someone like Jeremy Corbyn, who I assume is an avatar for you as well, has gotten on board?
Yeah, I mean, I do a bit. It's kind of interesting that you've got this kind of swell of support from the grime community. Obviously, they're having a massive moment and they're kind of crossing over to the mainstream. And it's nice to see that they're actually kind of lending some weight and support behind it. It's the kind of thing that, you know, rock music used to do, like have a say about things that were going on in people's real lives. But now it's obviously moved on. We've had that discussion about guitar music being totally irrelevant. So this might, like, I don't know if people listening to grime are necessarily going to be, you know, rallied to go out and vote, but maybe. I mean,
it's definitely a better strategy for Labour than going on Twitter and being like, do you think that you could be an MP? Let us know.
That was a good one, yeah. I enjoyed that.
Slide into our DMs and give us your manifesto.
I mean, at the same time, though, we talk about the sort of, you know, election a couple of months ago where Trump got in with the support of basically like Ted Nugent, Loretta Lynn, Azalea Banks, and briefly Aaron Carter, but then he deleted it. As opposed to like Jay-Z and Beyonce throwing Hillary Clinton at concert. And Katy Perry taking on all comers and so forth. Like, you've got to question how much musical endorsements are really worth.
Yeah,
well,
I mean, some of the support is great. I mean, Novelist support was unequivocal. He tweeted, "Do not resign, the mandum need him."
Yeah.
Stormzy did an interview with The Guardian in which he declared the leader of the opposition to be my man Jeremy. I saw some sick picture of him from back in the day when he was campaigning against anti-apartheid, and I thought, yeah, I like your energy. And we do like his energy.
I also
it's a bit low energy, but it's a good source of energy.
I enjoy this very, very Guardian sentence of, the politically active Novelist was once a deputy young mayor for Lewisham. He has tracks such as Tax the MPs, which layers someone screaming, liar, liar, pants on fire over a sample of a David Cameron speech. Oof, edgy, edgy stuff. No, it's interesting because, I mean, like it's always awkward to see, like, you know, a politician being like, down with the cool youth. Yeah. But I think everyone's really rooting for Corbyn this time. So yeah, let's hope that Craig's prediction is in fact correct.
And as well, it's not actually his doing, so
wrong,
to speak.
Sorry,
like,
prediction, sorry.
There's a voting registration website right now called Grime for Corbyn, featuring a song called Corbyn Rhythm, and which takes one of his speeches and puts it against like this massive instrumental.
Shockingly, it's not great.
And more people are tweeting hashtag grime for Corbyn.
I mean, this
manifesto
has never worked, really. No. you could maybe make a case for Tony Blair getting the kind of nudge from Britpop, but he was going to win anyway. Yeah. It wasn't like, oh, the artist rallied behind him and he just got him across the line. I mean, nice sentiment, but the future is bleak, folks.
But what kind of future does it hold for an artist like Avril Lavigne?
Don't you mean Melissa, Dave?
Well, I'm not sure, man, because about 12 years ago at this stage, perhaps more, there was a massive conspiracy theory, which I believe circulated on Live Journal, of all places, and essentially alleging that Avril Lavigne passed away and was replaced by a lookalike that she had previously hired to kind of ward off anxiety and have her step out in public for her. For some reason, I guess just because Twitter and things just taking flight for no real reason, someone posited a thread about all this, essentially kind of repeating what had already been put out there before, and wouldn't you know it, it went viral.
Of course it did. Of course it did.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about the supposed differences, and, you know, we get back to this whole Paul McCartney thing of just looking at like two photos and being like, okay, this is strange. Lavigne wears trousers. Melissa prefers dresses and skirts is my favorite line.
Case closed.
Case closed.
Yeah, I like that. That's proffered as proof.
Yeah, also, like, this thing of, you know, the real Avril didn't really like the publicity when things kind of exploded at the start, so they just went to all this trouble of finding someone that looked exactly like her. What they would have done is just, like, you know, pumped her full of drugs or maybe just got her some, like, PR training.
Colm, you asked before on the show if I had a crush on Hayley Williams of Paramore fame back in the day, and I said no, actually, I didn't really.
But
Avril Lavigne, on the other hand.
Did you, yeah?
Oh my God, yeah.
Were you that skater boy?
I wish I was. I'll tell you what I wasn't, though.
So did you spend, like, a portion of time jealous of Derek Whitley from Sum 41?
Well, not
and
the,
Chad Kroeger.
Not in any kind of weird way that I thought that I could land Avril Lavigne and who were these rock stars palling around with my girlfriend.
Yeah.
I wasn't delusional.
Did Melissa say recently something about, like, the term skater boy was a revolutionary act or something like that?
Yeah, she did. Yeah. And she also tweeted out about, like, you know, her new record deal, and someone on Twitter quoted that tweet and went, oh, Melissa knows that we're suspicious, which I really enjoyed. But I guess the question I would ask, though, is, I mean, like, do you guys think that you're punk?
Sorry?
Do you think that you're punk?
No, absolutely not.
Craig?
Yeah.
Really?
Punk as fuck.
Wrong answer, man. Wrong answer. This is what you should have said.
I'm not a punk rocker. I don't have punk music. Maybe I have some punk characteristics about me. Did I say that properly?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe I have some punk characteristics about me, but I don't walk around calling myself punk. It's more punk to tell people you're not punk than to sit there and say that you are punk. And whatever. If you want to know what I think that I am, I think that I'm just a rock chick. And I like to rock out. I like to throw shit around. I like to go nuts. I like to lose myself on stage. I like to scream. I like to holler. I like to break things. I like to yell. I like to get my anger out.
So Avril or Melissa, yeah, I can't argue with that, and I won't even try. But something else was going on this week, I think we should give kind of a bit of a mention to. Craig, you're a huge fan of the Strokes.
Love them, yeah.
They're breaking news.
Yeah, this is known. There's a book coming out called Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001 to 2011 by Lizzie Goodman. New York Magazine ran an excerpt from this, which was just Talking Heads, essentially, a transcript of, and it was kind of basically the rise and fall of the Strokes and the New York rock scene at the time. It's been doing the rounds. It's quite the read.
Yeah, you kind of pushed it my way, and I'm glad you did, because it's a great read. And I love those Talking Heads things where people are being interviewed separately, because you get this, like, you're just jumping from one person's recollection of something to the next, and it's sometimes hilarious, but most of the time, like, you get a kind of proxy thing of, like, what actually went on.
Especially when they're all so wildly drug-addled.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like the Strokes had a really rough time. And the gist of the piece is kind of like, you know, they should have been the band that became the next Nirvana or whatever, and it didn't quite happen for them, and it lays bare really why. Lots of drug problems. Ryan Adams hanging around.
Well,
it's all Ryan Adams.
On the subject of that, former guest of the show, George Morahan, put up a tweet and said, "My favourite part of that Vulture Strokes retrospective was the smash cut that undermined known drug pusher Ryan Adams." And he did a screen grab which says the following. It says, "Julian Casablanca says, did I specifically tell Ryan to stay away from Albert?" That being Hammond Jr. "I can't remember the details, to be honest. I think heroin just kind of crosses a line. It can take a person's soul away. So it's like if someone is trying to give your friend a lobotomy, you're going to step in." Ryan Adams then is up next. "I didn't do drugs socially. I don't remember doing drugs with Albert ever. I wanted to smoke cigarettes and drink like dark red wine or vodka and write all night." And then the final quote here is James Endicott, former A&R exec, saying, "Albert getting into smack was just ridiculous." Now, George put up that tweet.
Yeah.
He didn't tag in Ryan Adams. And Ryan Adams favorited it.
Oh.
Or liked it or whatever. Yeah, I mean, know.
Yeah, Albert also talks about his kind of relationship with Ryan as well. And an even more damning indictment, I think, is that Ryan comes across as the guy at the party who's constantly just grabbing the guitar and going, "I'll just play this song." And then when someone else is just like, "Well, I have a go." And he's just like, no, I know that one. I'll play that. So, yeah.
It's terrible behavior. You will agree, Dave.
100%.
People sitting around a living room playing guitar, trying to impress somebody.
You know what, man?
It's like, come on, grow up.
And, like, what kind of song would you go for? I mean, like if you're the kind of reprobate who would, like, bust out, like, Knights in White Satin or something.
Can we have a bit of Knights in White Satin?
No, it's classic. Can't. No, we cannot.
I brought my guitar.
Yeah, I was about to say, you can go home and play it later.
"'Cause I love you. Yes, I love you."
Do you know what my favourite bit is, though? Not in Knights in White Satin, in the article.
It's that amazing.
It's when Courtney Love is described as the Strokes' Coke Yoda.
Coke Yoda.
My favorite
great
bit
term
is when somebody casually notes that Room on Fire is just as good as Is This It.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what? Room on Fire is kind of in its way also a perfect record.
I think it's a great album, but I don't think it's quite on the level.
Yeah, I'm the exact same.
It was definitely unfairly. It was kind of unfairly cut to shreds.
Oh, yeah.
Because it wasn't Is This It. But I couldn't
what
quite.
Is?
I couldn't quite meet that. Yeah, and again, I mean, like, you know, an article as good as this did make me go back to the Strokes once again. And I remember I've said before, you know, while I think His to Sit is amazing, I'm not sure if it's, you know, as good as everyone says it is, but it is. I think it's a phenomenal album.
So anyway, that article is part of New York Magazine right now. The book should be out soon. And yeah, very interesting reading. Hopefully, in fact, once we have a chance to actually digest the whole thing, we might be revisiting it on this pod. However, it has been crazy busy as far as tracks are concerned this week. So we shall kick off with a taste of what we're hearing. I'm going to pick a number. Number 3, please.
Okay, buddy. It's Muse. They're back. It's called Dig Down, and it sounds like Queen.
Dig down. Dig down. Dig down. And find faith when you're close to the end. With a gun to your head, you must find a way. When friends are thin on the ground and they try to divide us, we must find.
So that's Muse, as I said, not giving up the Queen Tribute Act anytime soon. What did we think, gentlemen?
Womp. It's trite, isn't it? It sounds like something that's going to be played over the montage of like someone coming back from injury or some community initiative to fucking plant flowers in the roundabouts or something. It's crap. Like it's not just, oh no.
I didn't hate this. I will say that it's certainly, I wanted something more like Origin of Symmetry style, because that's kind of the return that I've been hoping for them for quite some time, and clearly we're not getting it. I mean, like, it reminded me a little bit of Madness, which I feel is actually a genuinely excellent song that they put out a while ago, even if that does also flirt with Queen and quite blatantly with U2 as well. I used to love Muse. They were a big tempo band for me growing up, and I kind of went off them. This is disappointing. I didn't think it was dreadful.
That's the lyrical sentiment that's killing me here.
Is there lyrical sentiment?
Well, Trump's a clown, and, you know, we need to soldier on.
Yeah, and, like, our video was inspired by a TED Talk, and you're like, of course it was. Of course it was.
Matt Bellamy's actually selling his condo in Lake Como, or by Lake Como in Italy. I was reading this today on businessinsider.com, because they had like photos of it and stuff. Apparently he now lives in LA. He spends most of his time in LA. He bought one house off Adam Carolla, and he bought another gaff for $7 million a couple of years ago off Pete Sampras.
Oh.
And there was one shot, there was like shots of the inside of this Italian gaff, and there was actually photos of the bathroom. It's just like this massive bathroom. And I was thinking, you know, Matt Bellamy, he loves his kind of tech and his guitar stuff. I'm like, he definitely wrote some guitar stuff while sitting on that toilet.
So did Prince, though.
And that's all I have to say about this song.
Every room Prince's gaff was wired for sound.
Yeah.
That quiz that we did recently, by the way, my childhood adoration for Pete Sampras was brought to the fore. Remember that?
He was a hairy man.
Slam dunk smash.
Probably more so now.
Very hairy man.
This is, as you say, like, I'd written down latter-day Queen rubbish, really. Yeah. And the sentiment doesn't really work with that wompy nonsense. And then the guitar volcano thing arrives about, like, the final third. But it doesn't actually, it's not building towards that. It's just tacked on. And it's
uninspiring. They certainly are digging down creatively. And at least it's not about drones, though, I suppose.
That's always a good thing, isn't
Craig,
it?
May I have a number, please?
Number 1.
Okay. Back at it once again. It's Mogwai. Scottish instrumental Mad Men, Mogwai, back once more with a song called Cool Vereen, which is effing up there in the worst song titles of all time stakes. I'm a fan. I've always been a fan of Mogwai. I think they are definitely recognised rightly as forebearers of post-rock, even though they hate that term. They make glorious, gorgeous, sweeping instrumental sounds. I'm a huge, huge fan. I mean, this is more of the same, but like, what else are they going to do at this stage of their career? I quite like this.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's not reinventing the wheel, but it's demonstration of what they can do really well. It's kind of slow burning, and there's order in the chaos when it expands a bit. I suppose, you know, this is what their 9th studio album this is taken from. Every Country's Sun is what it's going to be called out September. But so this is their 9th studio album. Then, like, they've got a bunch of soundtrack work in between. They obviously had, like, Minor Victory spin-off for Stuart Braithwaite and all the rest of it. You're kind of forgiven for thinking, like, do we need another Mogwai LP? But then you listen to this and you're like, okay, no, actually a full album of this I can definitely work with. It's not changing things in any dramatic way, but it's very good.
If someone's thinking of doing like an arty film where which just basically consists of Zidane on the touchline for Real Madrid, this will work perfectly. It is definitely from that kind of Black Spider school of, or like, you know, earlier still kind of Come On, Die Young, subtle, dark, brooding, beautiful stuff. It's really good. I liked it. I liked the last LP, Rave Tapes, which was kind of more, a lot of it was quite electronic and stuff.
That's true.
And I remember
at
the time people were kind of like, oh, this isn't what Mogwai's about. And it's just like, they're kind of damned if they do, damned if they don't.
Absolutely. You know? But they're damned if they do, damned they don't, even from their own fans. I saw their 20th anniversary show in the Olympia. I think it was 2 years ago now at the stage.
Yeah, that was the time your laptop broke and I was like, if a hipster goes to see Mogwai and can't blog about it, doesn't make a sound.
Can't tweet about it, is what you said. Yeah, yeah, that's when I poured a pint glass of water on my laptop, mate. Rest in peace. And I remember even the fans were like, is that it? After it was over. And he was like, that was fucking amazing. They only took the roof off, Kasabian style, when the synth in Remurdered kicked in. That was one of the loudest things I've ever heard. That was an incredible gig. I'm such a fan of Mogwai. Stuart Brightway, you mentioned there, is a great guy. I've had the pleasure of interviewing him a couple of times. Mm. Very gregarious fellow. And yeah, they're a band that I'm happy to just keep making music. Like, I don't need them to be wildly different every time. If it justifies a tour and you get a few new great tracks out of it, which again, as Craig says, very atmospheric, very soundtrack-like, it's a welcome return for me, and it's a win for this week's Song of the Week. Mm-hmm. Oh, hang on, there's four more. Cullum, give me a number.
Number five, please.
Okay, this is a band that Craig adores, and I wonder if you do too. This is Broken Social Scene. Could I say at what point I would gain perspective, let alone no, I had it. Survival by the soundtrack made of our short lives, making sense of all the ground. This one's called Hug of Thunder. Did it wrap you in a warm embrace?
It did. I really liked it. I love Broken Social Scene. Yeah. And I think, you know, you actually mentioned wrapping in a warm embrace. Kind of intimacy is something that they do really well, especially for, you know, a large sprawling collective or whatever. And this song does it very well as well. It's got that kind of slow build again. It's quite lush by the end of it. It's great to hear Leslie Feist back in the fold. And apparently they're going to have like the full complement of everyone who's ever been part of Broken Social Scene as part of the new album, Amy Million and Emily Haynes and everyone else. Yeah, great start as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, apparently all 15 of them, there is really is 15 are back on board. And yeah, I mean, Leslie Feist is a legend. This is a great song. We had Halfway Home already, which was much more kind of, we're back, kind of charging, you know, grandiose thing. And this is the other side of Broken Social Scene. And it's even kind of more exciting for me. I mean, I just think it's a gorgeous song. They always kind of, they sound like summer to me as well. Just like, I love their kind of previous LPs. So this arriving around about this time was like, ah, this is great. It's so like evocative.
I've talked before about my sort of happy festival memories of the band, which indeed were revisited.
Oh, you and Toby?
Year. Yeah.
You and Toby Kerr?
So yeah. So it's nice to think that, there might actually be quality Broken Social Scene songs to be played at festivals in the future.
I listened to this the other night when there was like a blazing sun and then there was a massive sun shower which got quite heavy. So it was like this gorgeous kind of like closing off of summer into like this really loud rain on my window, which is like one of my favorite sounds in the entire world. Love that. Huge fan. And it kind of dovetailed quite well. And this is a beautiful song.
Yeah. Canada's best band. Sorry, Arcade Fire.
Yeah, I might go along with that.
Yeah, why not?
Fair enough. Craig, there's three numbers left and they are 2, 4, and 6.
I want a 2, please.
Okay. It's back to her roots, Miley Cyrus. The sky is more blue in Malibu. Next to you in Malibu. Next to you. We watch the sun go down as we walk. Now, this song is called Malibu. It's been getting a bit of a kicking in the press, particularly Pitchfork, who noted that it makes Sheryl Crow sound edgy. Is it just me, or is this quite charming?
I mean, this is the thing. It's weird to kind of put into the topography, I suppose, of Miley Cyrus's career, where if this song had arrived in, say, 2010, when it was kind of Party in the USA style.
Great
shit.
Song.
You kind of say,
what an era. The whole punk thing was kicking off.
But you kind of see how it would fit in, or like, you know, you would expect it from her. But listening to this, it's as though the whole, you know, bangers, maturation, Flaming Lips, Dead Pets, all that has just been pushed to one side again.
Oh yeah.
She's, and you're just like, what are we getting?
It's a reset. It's a hard reset.
She's reining it in. She's gone too far. She regrets the, you know, Wrecking Ball stuff. I mean, she looked into the void and Wayne Coyne looked back at her. And this is the result.
Episode title. Can you blame her?
But yeah, this is like, you actually start hearing that kind of like Tennessee twang again in this.
Yeah.
And then it does, like, you have the muted electric guitar and things.
It's got a weird Phoenix guitar line.
Yeah, you kind of, it seems like it's going to be a weird alt country but poppy thing. Yeah. And then it goes into a kind of like Chris Martin Adventure of a Lifetime thing with the guitars. And it's totally just, I mean, it's very beige. It's about getting back together with Liam Hemsworth and standing on a beach and the sky being blue.
Beige as it gets.
And then being like the waves coming in and out, and it's not great. But it's fine. It's inoffensive.
I don't know why I like this, but I do. I
mean, you know what? I will say one thing in its defense. I quite like the fact that she sounds quite weary.
Yeah.
Like,
well, there's a line where she says something to the fact that she goes, oh, if you told me I'd write this song 3 years ago or something. And I was like, I believe her. Yeah. Like, I actually believe it. And I believe because of going through that kind of phase of her career and just going so far in one direction, now going to the other one. I always like to see people try something different, try and even reinvent themselves. Now, granted, there's an article on Vulture at the moment called The Trouble with Woke Pop Stars, which is worth a read. Yeah. And they kind of compare Katy Perry to Miley Cyrus, to Lana Del Rey, with the conclusion being that Lana Del Rey is actually, like, you know, the person that they should aspire to be, because she has always kind of at least lived her own truth, her own narrative, and all that kind
of stuff. Live your own truth, Dave.
Yeah, you know.
Every day.
It's a ridiculous sentence, I know. Thank you for seizing it upon it immediately, Craig.
There will be an apology next week.
What I would say is that the article is interesting, though, and it kind of posits that, like, this Miley Cyrus thing is a bit cynical. And maybe it is, but I kind of believe her, and I quite liked it. Now, the video is interesting because the video is, like, the underlying definition of how she is effectively, like, between two personas, so to speak.
Right.
Because it's a mix of, like, wholesome and...
Not Hannah Montana.
No, not quite. But it's her on a beach.
This is old ground. I mean, this has been covered.
But it's her, like, parading around on a beach, and she has balloons and isn't wearing much. And it's like, but it's this mix of, like, wholesome and kind of, you know, provocative. And it's like, okay. I mean, like, it's kind of like, it's like Boardwalk Empire, Jimmy Tanuki. You can't be half a gangster. I'm wondering if she can pull this off. Right. I wonder if she can pull off this kind of reboot, because that's what it feels like. But no, I mean, I went in expecting this to be like country trash, and maybe it is, but I don't know. It has charm, and I quite liked it.
It's not as good as Malibu by famous Coke Yoda, Courtney Love, I have to say.
It's probably unlikely to have the cultural zeitgeist impact of that song, I agree. Cullum, there are 2 numbers left, and they are 4 and 6.
I'm going for the bottom number 6, please.
All right, it's Selena Gomez. This song is called Bad Liar, and it will remind you of somebody.
Guess I'm a bad liar. I see how your tension builds. It's like looking in a mirror. You're touched like a happy pill, but still all we do is fear. What could possibly happen next? Can we focus on the love? Paint my kiss across your chest. If you're the art, I'll be the brush.
Who does it remind you of, Craig?
Psycho killer. Kiss could say.
Yes, she is clearly reaching into the Talking Heads well there. Does she do a good job? I think she does.
Yeah, it's a great song, actually.
Yeah, it's a belter. It's very good. It's a fucking belter. I love this. Cool.
You know what?
Here we go.
I must say, I like a lot of the sort of parts here. As you say, the kind of Talking Heads sample, or borrowing from Talking Heads, at least, I suppose. The kind of less is more approach, which we've obviously given props for as far as Selena is concerned before, and a song like Good For You. But to me, it sounded a bit twee or something. It sounded like this is the song that would soundtrack like One Tree Hill or Gossip
Girl. I gotta disagree with you, man, because she's actually just put out a cover recently of Only You for that wildly problematic 13 Reasons Why show, which I quite liked as well. It was a bit of a twist on that kind of industrial pop take on it, which I quite enjoyed. This to me sounds like an artist in full command and confidence, which was definitely beginning to come to the fore on Revival, that album which has Good For You on it from a couple of years ago, which I really enjoyed. No, this to me, I must disagree. This to me sounds like someone who was very, very at the top of her game almost. I think this is an absolute belter, and I'm going to say it right now, guys. Sound of the summer. It's the sound of the summer.
Daft Punk joins forever. A lengthy playlist there, yeah.
But no, this is as strong as anything that Calvin Harris has released off that new record so far for me.
Ooh, I think it's great. Know about that.
Really good, meandering in the best kind of way pop song with a lot of different hooks. I know what Combs getting at. It does feel like a jigsaw that's been, that's been dropped, but yeah. I think it's very impressive.
I agree with that meandering thing. I mean, it has that Talking Heads sample, but actually reminds me more of Tom Tom Club in terms of like a Genius of Love thing, where it's just this repetitive, very sparse thing, and then what she does on top of that is the kind of the meat of it, and it's good, yeah.
And finally this week, and perhaps appropriately to bring us into our album review in a moment, it's The Stripes. They're behind closed doors, but they're still making a lot of noise, am I right?
You're not wrong. Put your pants on the long finger. Leave your wife. Promise the kids you'll see them. But they know that's just feeble optimism. You like to think you'd have kept in touch. Some consideration for someone you love. But you would never bury into altruism.
Okay, The Stripes. Now, if someone has never heard The Stripes before, you guys have been up close and personal. Tell us who they are.
Yeah. So, I mean, The Stripes obviously emerged at the age of, 15, 16, 17? There's a year between the youngest and oldest, or 2 years between them. But either way, it's very, very, very young guys who were playing this kind of throwback 80s blues rock, or 60s blues rock, should I say. Mm. And obviously looked odd, quite frankly, because
they wore suits. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Even though they once slagged me in a hot press tent in front of a full audience for wearing a polo shirt. And it was a nice polo shirt. They're like, nice polo shirt, mate.
Didn't you get your own back by telling them that they had to be in bed at a certain time?
I didn't tell them they had to be in bed, but you play for, I was talking to their manager. Yeah. And I was just like, see you off now, are you? It's like, yeah, I'll call it a night.
It could have been worse,
I was like,
man.
Cracked open again.
It could have been worse. You could have like really, really trashed them in a review that your own father said was too harsh.
So we turned to Dave.
And then one of their mothers got involved in the comments and slagged off my music taste. Yeah, I wrote that review and I stand by it.
Wow. Well, they've certainly changed their sound. So,
oh, you mean the singer has decided who he wants to sound like now, has he?
Well, the singer has always kind of sounded like himself. But what they've done is, and they've been saying this for the last couple of years, their favourite kind of record seems to be My Aim Is True by Elvis Costello. And, I mean, this sounds very much like that. It could have fallen out of 1980. I mean, it kind of has squeezes up the junction as its sacred text, really. And I very much enjoy the kind of modishness of it. And I think they've taken a lyrical step forward. Yeah, it's fun. When it slows down the tempo towards the end, I think it drags on. It's a good minute too long. But the initial kind of flurry, I was like, oh yeah, they're doing something quite interesting.
Sounds like the opening credits to a bad Guy Ritchie knockoff heist gangster lads movie.
So something by Paul Weller is what you mean.
Pretty much, yeah, yeah. Call him.
I don't mind this. I mean, like, is it great? No, it's not. But it certainly seems to have a recognition that the goalposts have moved somewhat. Mm. That, you know, they could probably get away with certain things and youthful exuberance would sort of fill in the gaps and, you know, almost people seeing them as a bit of a novelty act, which fairly or otherwise was probably how they were viewed a little bit when they first arrived.
Oh, completely. Yeah.
Now, obviously, you can't get away with that anymore. You're into your 20s. You've been around the block a few times and, you know, you've got to make music that's going to stand on its own 2 feet. And this is certainly a move in the right direction in that regard, I think.
I'm still curious to see what they will sound like in 10 years or if they'll even still be abandoned in 10 years. If they manage to overshadow the gimmick, I will reassess my statements. But I do believe that at the start they were quite cold, cynical and calculated, even if probably not their doing.
You know what? Can I just jump in and say that last year I literally had to interview them at the drop of a hat when someone else didn't turn up to do it. Again, in front of a crowd, and they could not have been nicer.
Oh, they're great. Yeah, they're great.
Like, they actually helped me out because clearly I didn't know anything. I hadn't researched.
And they're very, very passionate music fans. And that's what you're hearing. You're hearing kind of kids that have been trying to, you know, process the stuff they're listening to. And of course, it's going to sound like their influences. But yeah, I think they could have an interesting career.
Marry them, why don't you?
I just might.
Well.
All of that rigmarole brings us to the main event this week.
Yeah, and quite fittingly, a guy who we first got to know in his teens and has now essentially moved into adulthood.
His name is Harold Styles. Mm-hmm. His album is called Harry Styles. And this, let's have a track. This song is called Woman.
Hi, I'm Eric Monkman. I'm from Oakville, Canada, and I'm studying for a master's in economics. Steven?
Okay, that's clearly not the song. Can we have Woman, please? Okay, I don't know what's happening. Let's go for a different one. How about Kiwi? No, I don't get it. I mean, that was clearly American Woman by Lenny Kravitz.
Play Caroline.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. No, that's stuck in the middle with you.
I see what's happening here.
Craig, two ghosts, you say? Here's that.
How I wish you were here.
Okay, that's blatantly Pink Floyd. Wish You Were Here. What, like?
Probably Only Angel.
It's just Brown Sugar. This is getting out of hand. How about Ever Since New York, maybe? You were so strange. You didn't have the decency to change the sheet. Oh, girl, you were my... Okay, well, that's just Prince, so... Can we please have an actual song from the Harry Styles record?
Meet me in the hallway. I just left your bedroom. Give me some more. Is there any more to do?
Okay, that's Meet Me in the Hallway, the opening track on Harry Styles, and probably the best minute on the album, I would say, the first minute. And then he starts singing a bit too loud, and then he gets a bit more into it. And I was really enjoying the haze beforehand. I quite liked the serpentine guitar and the bass notes. It was kind of felt quite hypnotic, and then he kind of steps all over the arrangement. But I still think this is one of the better tracks on a record, which, if you hadn't guessed... really, 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 really borrows from different things.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we knew that really from the first two singles, where Sign of the Times was, well, the name was from Prince, the style was from Bowie, there was touches of Queen, the Beatles, Robbie Williams' Angels in there, and then Sweet Creature, which was just Blackbird, basically. So we knew that this was going to be derivative. I think what was probably a little bit surprising is how broad the palette from which he's been borrowing sounds has actually been, because this has managed to both be unoriginal but so spectacularly varied at times.
Yeah. Is he the savior of rock and roll, gentlemen? Because he certainly is going for that sound. And I kind of have to say, I mean, when we're talking about some of the songs that trailed the release of this album, I had kind of suggested, and I remember even saying, sorry, maybe this is a bit patronizing, but he didn't really sound like, or come across like, someone that really cared about the music whatsoever. Right. I will say, at least with the styles he's going for this, I mean, he's clearly not going for like number one or hopping on any bandwagons. Yeah. I mean, this is stuff that is definitely not flavor of the month at the moment.
But where is he? Where is Harry Styles? Where is the person? Where is the artist? Where is the craftsman?
Well, I think there's a few glimpses on this. I agree with you. I think he exists best in the kind of that hazy thing. I think he actually has a very good voice.
He does have a very good voice.
I agree.
I think there's certain moments where you kind of get this jaded sense of where he's at and who he is, and he can pull it off really well, which makes me think he could actually have some longevity.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, he borrows so liberally from, you know, other sounds and melodies and stuff that it's actually kind of, you know, a fine listen.
You see,
you're not like, I have to turn this off.
I mean, like you said, that there's moments where, like, and the moments are very few and far between for me. I mean, he said very earnestly that this was going to be his honest album. I think he was quoted talking to the Sunday Times last week, said, like, you know, at certain times you write songs where you just want to tell the whole story. And if this is actually him telling the whole story, then he's an incredibly boring and uneventful life, because there's not much here.
The problem with this, I suppose, is, yeah, lyrically, I mean, it's what we were talking about in the news, where rock music or guitar music doesn't really seem to have anything to say, because these are all just, I mean, he's described it as a song cycle about, like, relationships, and that's such a kind of pretentious way of saying, yeah, I'm just kind of talking about vague women I might have had sex with. Like,
well, that's actually a point I want to bring, I want to talk about, because he got a lot of, you know, hashtag woke points for his profile. Very, very gushing profile penned by Cameron Crowe, writer at large for Rolling Stone.
Yeah, kind of bigging up female girl fan base.
Yeah,
basically.
I mean, like, essentially, which is great. I mean, like, I mean, he was like, kind of like Harry Styles was saying, like, why is a teenage girl's opinion on music any less credible than a 30-year-old hipster guy's? Now, I gotta say, my ears were quite burning on that one. But he's right. He's totally right. Like it shouldn't come down to ageism or gender at all. And I think that's a cool thing to say. And, like, fair fucking play to him for saying that, and for, like, having the back of a fan base that he totally appreciates the opportunity to tune into their frequency for. However,
yes,
then you get to the album, and his portrayal of women...
Yeah, he's kind of burying them a little bit.
It's not
he?
Good, is it? Because, yeah. I mean, like... You know, there's lyrics in here, like, he's got one, like, you know, in Kiwi, where he says, "And now she's all over me, it's like I paid for it." He's got one, I think it's Only Angel, where he says, "I couldn't take you home to mother in a skirt that short."
Yep.
The object of his desire in Carolina is a good girl, but she's pretty much a vapid, pretty vacant nothing.
Yeah.
Woman, which we heard Eric Munkman's excellent version of there leading us in. It's just called Woman. Like, the
doesn't even give her a name.
What the fuck? So, yeah. Like, I just feel like...
In the final song, I think he's demanding an apology from a girl who's moved on.
Yeah, and it's like...
After he's had a wank.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong. I mean, like, so many songs are born out of heartbreak and born out of resentment and all that kind of stuff. And it's how you choose to dress it up. And on other tracks, like, he's clearly pining over someone that he has massive respect for. But, like, it's that kind of strange confliction, especially if you're going to come out and make a statement that big, in which people will just run and screenshot that quote and go on Twitter and go, "Oh, it turns out Harry Styles is a really cool guy." And it's like, yeah, well, maybe he is, but, like, surely if you have the ability, and he has the ability, and if you have the power, and you got to think that he must have some power and some clout of his own, bring that to your songs, mate.
That's exactly it. I mean, you know what, though? To be perfectly honest, it doesn't trouble me massively if he's not bringing that to his songs. If he's putting, you know, his actual self into this song. So basically, however he may feel, just tell us, let us know. And he doesn't do that. And you mentioned there's a lyric at the start of From the Dining Table, which is actually, for me, perhaps the album's highlight, because it sounds like a song that a guy in his 20s might conceivably write.
Yeah, Ryan Adams wrote it about when he was in his 20s. Yeah.
Let me down into your beautiful garden, flowers in the love of mine.
Sorry, go ahead.
But so... He was asked by the New York Times about the masturbation lyric, and, you know, he kind of waffled for a bit about context and interpretation. It was very much a standard answer that you get from a musician who doesn't really want to get into too much depth about a particular line. But then he said, "Was that an all right answer for the question? I think it was all right. I think we danced around that one okay." And it's like, I think that's the mentality that was brought to this album as a whole, was just, is this all right? Is this okay? Does this tick enough boxes and keep people off my back and so on and so forth? It felt, yeah, clawing and just looking for kind of legitimacy and authenticity and approval throughout the record, just like he did with that answer.
Yeah, and I do think, I mean, rather than be, you know, problematic, I think a lot of this stuff is just a bit groan-worthy because it's so cliched. I mean, it's just like, oh, she's a good girl. I think it's more of a shortcoming in ability to kind of write nuanced, deep stuff.
That's
as opposed
it.
To not, you know, deciding not to make any kind of great, you know, statements.
This also feels like Harry Styles and the session musicians.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it just feels like, hey, we had some recording time. Harry's a big fan of this particular Elton John song. Here's his take on it.
You know what? I'll be fair, Dave, and say that, like, if you're suggesting there was kind of laziness here, or any sort of complacency, because we said before, like, they know they're going to sell millions here. And they know
he sold
out
his entire world tour in, like, 10 seconds.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, laziness and complacency isn't
complacency
a factor here.
Complacency is a factor here.
I don't think so.
A lack of quality control?
But Dave, you see, the thing is, like, I think rather than complacency, it's almost the exact opposite. This to me sounds like restless and insecure in any one sound, and that's why it ends up jumping about so much. It sounds like it's desperate to have that sort of, like, you know, context in a sort of broader cultural way, that it's ended up sort of working itself into a tizzy rather than sort of resting on its laurels.
Yeah, and in fairness, I mean, to the musicians on it, some of the kind of highlights that actually hold this whole thing together is interesting stuff going on underneath kind of what he's singing. Yeah. And there's some great bass lines. Again, you know, obviously some of them sound eerily similar to other songs. But I think it's well put together. It's kind of concise enough. I mean, the quality level isn't hugely high, but it's not like, well, this is a total absolute dud.
No, not at all. But it's also, it's a wool pulling over the eyes exercise as well, because an awful lot of people are like, oh, hang on, this is all right to like.
Well, now you see, this is the thing. Yeah, like, the reaction to this album has been generally positive. I mean, to be fair, it hasn't had the sort of like swing from the chandeliers reviews that the first single suggested that it might get, but it's been fairly well received.
I'd argue that's been generous.
Yeah, well, I would too. I think it's been very generous. And the problem, I think, is that the bar was set
so low. Yeah,
they literally said, you know, like, does it sound different to One Direction? Oh, fair play. And that's not
There's also a dearth of compelling male solo pop acts at the moment.
Absolutely. But you know what?
He's filling a gap in the market, but the gap in the market is one that we don't quite need.
Yeah, but as well, I mean, like, you mentioned kind of like, you know, compelling pop acts. And I suppose if he'd gone the direction of, like, you know, an R&B tropical pop, maybe they'd be the comparisons that should be made. And indeed, I think he'd fall quite short on that. But, like, with this, you know, for me, it's not good enough to say, like, oh, it doesn't sound like the work of a boy band member. And by no means am I suggesting that these names are like the Mount Rushmore of modern songwriting or whatever. But if you take, like, your James Bays and George Ezra's and even Ed Sheeran's, 20-something-year-old British singer-songwriters right now, how does this stack up? Really, really poorly, I think.
Not only that, but I mean, like, a lot of people are kind of saying, ah, well, there we go. We know who won that battle when we stack up Zayn's album next to this. I'm sorry, Zayn's album was disappointing, but at least it was... It felt like it was him in his own words.
I don't know. I felt like that was a bit of a compromise as well. I would rather listen to this record than Ed Sheeran's latest, I have to say.
Yeah, sure. But at the same time, would this record just make you not go, I'd actually rather listen to the best of Elton John?
Yeah, Elton John's everywhere at the moment. Yeah. I mean, Bob John Misty at least is doing, you know, kind
Elton John's
of
great.
Stuff. Like, he is. I mean, but it is very much that soft rock 70s vibe. That's kind of hard not
to... It's a driving album. It's a karaoke record. That's what this is.
And there's a level of mollycoddling with this as well, though, where it's just like, ah, look at him there, all edgy and rocking out, and it's like
in his pink suit.
Yeah, but it's like he's not a 7-year-old who's just emerged from the dressing up box. Like.
But that's what it feels like. People want Harry Styles to be good, to succeed, to be good. Like, for whatever reason, they're just like, oh, look at him there, he's handsome.
Because like when he was in One Direction, he started growing his hair and getting tattoos, and he looked a bit like someone that might have been in the Rolling Stones in the 60s, and people were just like,
so that's who he is now. Run with that. Yeah.
It kind of is, isn't it?
But see, the thing is, like I say, I mean, like, he is not, you know, playing a character, and he's no longer so young that you can go, oh, well, that's kind of cute.
Yeah, he's 24, I believe.
23 or 24. 23.
You turned 23 in February.
Yeah.
Okay. Harry Styles fan site.
But either way, like, he's a high profile, multi platinum, like, music industry veteran at this point, as weird as that sounds.
Nobody's expecting Metal Machine music here.
No, but at the same time, you know...
That'll be his next album.
It's fair to demand a lot more than we've been given.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. There's a 1-2 punch of songs in this that literally made me, as I was running, like, guffaw.
Cry.
Is it Only Woman loudly. And then Kiwi?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It's the loudest I've laughed since I terrified Cullum.
Man.
After he suggested that people were eagerly awaiting
I described Kiwi as the unholy union of Scouting for Girls and Jet.
Somewhere in Australia, the lead singer of Wolfmother is wobbling around on a 10th point of the night just going, I told you it's still fucking relevant.
It also made me think that, like, if he had grown up in, like, 1980s LA instead of wherever he lived in Britain.
He'd be dead by now.
Yes, yeah. And he would have been in Motley Crue, actually. What he wants to be is a 80s glam rocker, I think. Like, that's totally his attitude. So this is a weird glam pastoral record.
Are we in
this
weird moment now where the Stripes are starting to develop a bit more musical teeth than him?
Can I say, Ever Since New York, I think, is a great song. There, I said it.
No, it is.
It's actually... But... Just separate yourself from Harry Styles in the context of this album. It's a good song.
It's a good song.
And it's exactly what he should be doing. I mean, lyrically it works.
Yeah, but it's a combination of Baker Street and a Prince song.
Well, I know. But listen, I mean, everybody nicks stuff at this stage.
Yeah, on every track on this record. It is a good song. It's a bit long, though. And is it that great song where, like, there's a lyric on it when I was like, holy shit, that's the fucking... That's my kind of... thesis for this record. Talk amongst yourselves, guys, while I go.
Oh, is this the one where he's talking about, like, just I'm bored with, you know?
No, it's not that.
There's a really good lyric in where he's like, I like the image of, like, there's no water in this swimming pool. I'm like, yeah, that is a proper, that's what Harry Styles' life
is. It right.
Where he's hanging out at gaffs where there's no water in swimming pools.
Yeah, you know, I've been there, like,
well, Harry Styles has, and that's what he should be talking about.
I think coming away from this album as well, it's just that weird sensation where we often say, especially with a debut album or a solo album, we say, like, you know, what direction are they going to go in, or what direction are they headed in? Whereas right now, there's about six different directions
as
that
opposed
he could
to
go.
So
I'll leave it, Craig. We're trying not to. But seriously, yeah, it's just like, what might album number two sound like? Who knows? Literally no fucking idea from listening to this.
What we can say is he's got good taste in music.
Sure.
He's got a good voice.
He's
when
stealing
it's used
from okay
when it's,
sources. Yeah.
When it's put in the right context, he actually has a very good voice.
Yeah, no, I agree
with
that.
If he could be molded, if he got songwriters in, actually the bizarre thing is the last like five songs are all from the same like four songwriters including him.
Yeah.
But they're so weirdly different.
You know what the other thing as well though is that like for me at least I say try to tell those other songwriters and collaborators to step back for a while. Because as much as he says, you know, I'm going to write an honest album, you can't write an honest album when you've got five other lyricists.
Every song has like six writers per track.
You
yeah.
can't do that.
By the way, the lyric I was looking for from Ever Since New York in the chorus, which he says a lot, is tell me something I don't already know.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great chorus.
Yeah, but come on, tell me something line. I don't already know. Yeah, Are you kidding me?
I know, yeah.
And to be fair as well,
but that's why I love that song. It's such a jaded thing of just him being like, okay, yeah, this like I'm sitting here with a person and we've got nothing to say.
I want
to
say as well that Sign of the Times fares no better in context than it did as a single. I have calmed down about it, but it's still not a good song. And also, Sweet Creature to me is an instant skip button. Like, yeah. I'm like, nope, can't listen to it.
Sure. I mean, like,
it's too mawkish.
I said at the time, yeah, like you could swing a cat at an open mic and hit five people who could do the same song. The problem is that I think those five people would also probably, in the minute afterwards where you apologise for hitting them with a cat, probably open up a little more than Harry Styles does on this record. I said it about Robbie Williams when we reviewed that all those months ago. I said, it's a bad sign if at the end of an album I feel like I know less than when I started. And that is kind of the case here, both stylistically, lyrically, melodically. There's just a lot of question marks that are left hanging when really you feel that, you know, the 10 song 40 minute effort should be answering them for you.
Yeah, I mean, are we going to do scores? Because I feel like if this wasn't a Harry Styles record and it was maybe some Irish act, you'd be kind of like, oh, maybe this is like a 6 out of 10. And then I have to go, because there's so much cribbing from other stuff, I mean, that's probably a point taken off. So it's probably a 5 out of 10. But I will say, as opposed to you, Colm, and I feel like I'm becoming the person on this podcast that's like the kind of teacher that's like, oh, he's a good lad. If there's, you know, stuff there, he'll do well. Yeah. I kind of see like he might grow into someone that at least has one or two, if not guilty pleasures, like songs that you're like, yeah, that's kind of a banger. Like, I think he might do some interesting stuff. There's signs there. So 5 out of 10 for me.
Yeah, I would go slightly lower. I was thinking, I think a 4 would be a little harsh. I'm going 4.5.
Well, you see, when it came to my own review, which I did for Drowning Sound, and which I did, by the way, you know, quite quickly because I actually
quickly
was,
Dave.
Well, see, this is the thing. I mean, like, it's a fair cop. I give out about people rushing reviews all the time. I had my review written like fucking less than 48 hours after I heard this record, because I was like, I've heard all I need to hear. I was like, I really have.
I don't know. That 15th listen, Dave.
I will say that I wrote a first draft at like, you know, 2 in the morning on the Saturday. I went back to it on Sunday afternoon, evening, and I did a second draft. But like, the point is, I had all I needed. I really did. Like this was so open and shut for me. It really was. And I wish it wasn't, but it was. Now, when it came to scores, which of course I find increasingly prickly and annoying, there's a magazine called Clash. If you go to clashmusic.com, or if you just go to Google and type in Clash Music, Clash likes to score, their rating system, they're 1 to 10. Someone did it up a couple of years ago, and they did a paragraph on each number. And I got to say, like, it's kind of my Bible, really. It totally works. So I came down like Cullum. I was like, 4 seems harsh, 3 seems really harsh, but it's feeling that way for me. So I want to qualify this by just explaining really quick their definition for a 3 and their definition for a 4. The definition for 3 out of 10 is this. An album of frequent failings, where ambition is evident, but its execution tremendously mishandled, could do better, so much very better. Their explanation for 4 out of 10 is, here's where things get more interesting, as the act in question has clearly aimed to extend its remit, to work up existing strengths and take them forward, but while not awfully realised, the results don't do justice to the intentions. Ultimately, the record cannot be recommended to anyone outside of its maker's most loyal fan base, and that's why my score is, of course, 3 out of 10.
Yeah. Fair enough. What else is worth giving a spin to, or should I say, what is worth giving a spin to full stop, since we can't seem to be recommending that very highly?
I finally got into Thundercat's new one, Drunk. Okay. It's amazing. It's really good. It's really, really good. It's just like that oddball soul thing. Very good. Have you listened to it?
I haven't.
Yeah. Check it out.
New Mac DeMarco, which we'd kind of talked about before its release. Mm-hmm. Finally got around to that. Very good, I must say.
Okay. I have been listening to the new Paramore record.
All right.
After Laughter. And I've only given it a few spins. It hasn't really held my attention. I've seen a lot of Paramore fans kind of raving about this one. Yeah. And specifically raving about Hayley Williams' personal lyrics and that kind of stuff. But I'm not really a fan. I don't really know them that well. So I feel like it's like, you know, outside the party looking in type thing. But sure. I will say that it doesn't quite maintain the strength of its lead single.
Yeah, I mean, we even said that when the second single came out, you felt it was kind of reverting to the
type a little bit. Yeah. But at the same time, it does have that aesthetic is up there throughout. And like, the problem is that, like, I mean, like, I guess if you're going to get personal, you guys could probably guess what that means. And what it means is, oh, here's the big acoustic song a couple of times. It's good. It's a good record. But I mean, ultimately, I don't know Paramore well enough to really kind of judge it properly. So what I would say is I found it interesting enough to listen to, but not memorable enough to stay in my head. Right. But Cullum and I are probably going to go along to that gig. So who knows?
Why not?
Perhaps the tracks will take on new life. Guys.
Yes, sir.
Thanks so much.
Thank
you. More than welcome, Dave. Thanks for having us.
Twin Peaks.
But we won't have Cullum next week.
No, I'm off to a wedding.
You actually waved. He actually waved there. Who'd you wave at? Craig.
This is adorable.
No, I'm literally off.
So we'll have to get by without you. Perhaps we'll bring somebody in next week. That's not entirely true. You will be here next week in some fashion.
I will indeed. Yeah, I'm going to contribute a little something towards the end of the show. So do tune in.
Well, I won't say who it is, but what I will say is we are bringing back our listening guide next week, and Cullum's choice this time. So we're going to have some phantom audio recorded at some point down the road. And who knows, might even get in someone to cover you, but who could possibly cover you, man?
That's true, mate.
I don't know.
Thanks.
I just don't know. Guys, you're both so handsome and pretty. I love you very, very much.
Hello, Alan here again. Instead of playing out this episode with an Irish track as we normally do, we're going to play a Chris Cornell song, a Soundgarden song, given the circumstances. So this is Black Hole Sun and all the stuff Dave normally says about there being no encore when there always is. Okay, bye.
In my eyes, indisposed, in disguises no one knows, has the face like
HPN, the Headstuff Podcast Network. See headstuff.org for more details.
Be winter soon, lads.
Oh, fuck off, would you?